On today's episode of May the Record Reflect.
I am never afraid of a strong opinion. I love when I get strong opinions out, because if this is an information gathering process and I have limited time, what better way to get information on someone than a strong opinion that leads to others noting their strong opinion? So I want that out. I look at it as I'm trying to smoke out the person that is going to be a problem either on my jury or for my case. And a strong opinion is the easiest way to smoke someone out.
That was Adam Kendall, and this is May the Record Reflect. Hello, and welcome back. This is Marcy Mankin, host of the monthly podcast of the National Institute for Trial Advocacy. I'm pleased to welcome Adam Kendall as our guest this month. As you gleaned from the title, Adam is here to talk about jury selection, how to seat the panel you're hoping for, or at least to avoid seating the one you aren't. Adam is a chief trial deputy district attorney in NIDA's hometown of Boulder, Colorado, where he supervises over a dozen DAs assigned to felony caseloads while handling a docket of serious cases of his own. He has served as a trial advocacy coach at the University of Colorado Law School since 2012 and has been teaching for NIDA for the past decade. Last year, he was selected as a member of NIDA's Next Generation faculty, which is the chef's kiss of up-and-comers among our instructors. And so with all of that in mind, I am more than happy that Adam Kendall is here to share with us his experience, guidance, and anecdotes on jury selection. Here's our interview. So, Adam, thank you for coming to join us on the podcast. We're excited to feature you.
Thank you for having me.
So, about a week ago, I had mentioned to somebody at work that you were my next guest and that we were going to be talking about jury selection, except instead of jury selection, I used the phrase that spelled V-O-I-R space D-I-R-E. And they said, you know, I never know the right way to pronounce that. Is it voir dire, voir dire? And it's true. You do hear both. So as we kick off this interview, Adam, I wonder if you could tell us, how do you pronounce that French term?
I have learned, because I think it all is learned behavior, it's voir dire is the way I learned it. However, I do have a penchant toward leaning to the Texas pronunciation I've heard, which is voir dire.
Okay.
I just can't pull that off because I am not Texan. So I stick with what I learned.
Well, and we always say that you have to be your authentic self in the courtroom. So
yes.
There you go. We could also just say jury selection, but I think that if we're being honest, it's actually jury deselection.
Yes, I very much agree with that.
So when you start voir dire, are you primarily trying to identify the juror who you think is going to be good for your case or bad?
My goal, because time is always precious with jury selection or voir dire, is to find the people that are going to be a problem for my case and my client and try to get them off of the jury. So that is the primary goal and my main goal.
So then apart from the verbal answers, the answers that they actually literally give you, what else are you paying attention to that would give you a sense of which way they might lean?
One of the things that I'm always looking for when I start jury selection, and again, because time is precious, is how other folks on the jury are responding. So while I may have one juror that's speaking to me and answering my question, I'm going to keep out of the corner of my eye watching for other jurors and see if there are facial reactions, see if there is head nodding or head shaking in response to that question. And I'm going to keep that in my back pocket. I may immediately go to that person, or I may wait depending on where I am in the jury selection process. But those physical cues can be huge in letting you know how someone's thinking or having a strong reaction, which is what I want to see. I want to get those strong reactions out and then explore those to see if I can find out more about that person and why they're responding that way.
So people always say, and in not just the context of trials, but in a lot of ways, that it's the quiet ones you've got to watch out for. So what do you make of the quiet ones?
That is tough. I have had experiences where the quiet ones will help you out, and they're just contemplative, and then they've been landmines for me before as well, where the quiet one is the one that hangs up the jury of 12. So the key to remember, again, is to try to get that information out in the limited time you have. So finding those people, especially if they're quiet, and ensuring that you get some open-ended questions to try to draw out as much information as you can, I think is key, because not knowing is the danger with the quiet person.
It is. And when I was thinking about this earlier this week and preparing for our discussion today, I remember that I had heard an anecdote at NIDA, and I can't remember if it was from an actual faculty member or if it was something that I read in like Modern Trial Advocacy when I was working for NIDA as a legal editor. But the anecdote was someone describing how they had this juror who ended up on the panel. They didn't want them there because this person didn't show any physical reaction. They were very quiet, didn't have much to offer, completely inscrutable. And after the trial, the counsel was talking to the jury panel and was just gobsmacked to find out that this quiet, inscrutable person ended up being the foreperson. And what the fellow jurors said was that this person showed leadership in the jury room because they paid really careful attention during the trial. And so they remembered things that the other jurors had not remembered, and they could process the information and were steady and calm and built consensus among the jurors. And counsel in the end said, you know, they were the least likely, and I never saw it coming.
Yep. Not a surprising story, and one that I think many folks have experienced if you do trial work.
So do you ever find it hard to get jurors to talk to you?
Oh, yes. Yes. Individual jurors. So the person you just described, I've had individuals that don't want to speak much because maybe they do have strong opinions and want to sit on the jury and don't want you to know that. You also have the people like the individual you just described who may decide, I listen. Right, I listen and I don't speak a lot, and I'm contemplative, and I determine what I think before I speak. I think a lot of us like to speak, I guess I'll say think out loud at times. And so when you have 30 minutes or 45 minutes to talk to an entire panel, that type of person is likely not going to have worked through their thoughts yet. And so you need to do what you can to get them to speak. So, you know, again, I think the key there is going to be individual questions. I think those are incredibly important to any jury panel, but particularly with individuals who have not been responsive to group questions, to call them out. And I usually start my voir dire by telling everyone, look, my goal, and I try to accomplish my goal every time, is to speak to everyone on this panel. So I'm going to call on each of you individually at some point or another. So no, I'm not trying to pick on you. Just I want to hear from you. So if I talk to you, know that I'm talking to someone, please listen, because odds are I'm going to talk to you next or 20 minutes down the road. And I just want to make sure we're all having the same conversation. So I'll preface my entire voir dire by discussing with jurors that my goal is to speak with everyone individually.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So do you have some favorite questions that you use or that you rely upon to build rapport?
Yes. So the rapport building is huge. And I will tell you, not only do you have issues with individual jurors not talking, but sometimes panels. I've found that panels will have they'll be composed a certain way. And sometimes they're super jokey and talkative. And other times it is just serious. And it is like pulling teeth to get anything out of them. So a lot of times I will feed off of what my jury panel is doing. I usually spend the first 30 seconds to minute, especially my job now as a prosecutor, because I'm the first one who gets to speak, introducing the concept, how I'm going to do it, what they can expect from me. Then I usually make the same joke, but I try to deliver it different ways of, you know, of course I'm a lawyer, and so I'm spending my limited time talking rather than actually asking the questions that I need to do in order to get information from you. and then I'll jump in at that point. But if I have a particularly difficult panel, sometimes I will start with just, so Ms. Smith, tell me about what you thought when you got your juror summons to be here today. So just start with some of those basic questions that are easy for folks to answer, because that's about them. That's about their response to being summoned, being forced to come into court. And we can start that conversation of, do you want to be here or not? Because usually jurors they're not excited to get a jury summons, but a lot of them want to participate. But if we start that conversation, we can start to pull out the folks that don't want to be there to the degree that they're not going to listen and they're going to do what they can to get off the jury. So we'll have that discussion. Then I'll usually take on the nerdy history part of myself where I would be excited to be a juror, but I'm never going to get to be a juror because I'm a trial lawyer. So we'll usually have that discussion just to try to ease folks into it.
So there are some jurisdictions, like federal courts in particular, where the judge conducts voir dire, and so it's not even in your hands. So in that case, how can you have impact? How can you get the information that you're hoping to get out of jurors when you don't get to ask the questions?
That is a lot more difficult than I'm usually in state court, and I'm lucky to still have a pretty robust ability to conduct a voir dire, jury selection. I think that's really hard when you're not able to answer those or ask those questions, and you're not able to allow the jury to assess you. So the key there is to pay attention to the answers that you're getting, even if you aren't able to ask those questions. So if the voir dire is coming from the judge, you want to make sure to pay attention to the individual who's answering, but again, that body language from other individuals around that person. The real advantage of having a judge do the voir dire, and I'd say the one advantage, because I like to control that, as any trial lawyer wants to control that process, is instead of having to focus on and pay attention to that juror to remain engaged, because that's part of the process too, is having them trust you and know that you're engaged, you don't have that issue because the judge is asking the question. So it does allow you a greater ability to really watch the rest of the panel, to see what the rest of the veneer is doing, to see how they're responding to an individual speaking or how they're responding to the topic. I know with some federal courts, judges will allow you at least to work through with opposing counsel what types of questions are being asked, or you know, what questions in a series of questions the court can ask. So really being thoughtful about what those questions are and why you want them to be asked is important. I think the other thing to keep in mind with that sort of very controlled court voir dire is to think about your client and think about your case. And what I mean by that is biases, because we all have biases, implicit bias. A lot of that is just comfort with or familiarity with what you know, or processes, or I guess hobbies that people have. So if the question is simple as, what do you like to read in your spare time? And the answer is, oh, I like fantasy novels because I just like getting out of my day-to-day grind and thinking about something that has nothing to do with my world. Well, is that true of your client? Is this case about the jury connecting with your client? And does your client share a similar trait? So even something that seems innocuous or thin, there may be a connection there. And then that could impact your direct of your client, because now you're going to touch on something that this juror can connect to, because it's just a shared experience. So it's more difficult, but there are definitely some things you can pick out of jury selection that's court run that can be helpful to your case and help you select or deselect, right? Do you know something about the opposing party that this juror might connect to? So you know you don't want that connection, so you're gonna try to remove them from the panel.
When you are surveying the various personalities in the veneer, are you looking for strong leadership as a plus, or are you trying to avoid someone with a really strong personality?
I will say, I think it depends on the case and it depends on the lawyer. For me personally, I generally like to avoid the strong personalities. I think it's fine if someone has opinions and a leadership quality, but what I want to avoid is a jury of one. So if we have a strong personality and someone that's going to direct some of the folks that maybe are more easily persuaded, that's always my fear, because my goal is to get a rational jury, because I'm moving forward with a case where I want rational folks who can analyze this in a rational way. And that jury of one is always an issue. I think we all avoid, at least everyone I've ever worked with, avoids putting a lawyer, as I said earlier, putting a lawyer on the panel because you're worried that lawyer is going to just steer everything. And I think that's the strong leadership is a lesser of that potential evil where now I'm just trying this case to a jury of one and that's not what I want to do.
So a jury of one, have you ever been surprised by who became the foreperson in any of your cases? Like, oh, didn't see that guy coming.
Yes. Yes, I have several times. The most recent one is we have try a lot of my cases here in Boulder County, Colorado. And so we'll get some college students that appear on our panels more than I have had in other places. And had an 18-year-old. So I had a very accomplished panel, very educated panel. Our community is very educated here. And had an 18-year-old freshman who was named the foreperson of the jury that we had.
That's amazing. Did you get any insight into how that happened?
I think this young man showed interest, but I also think he was just very likable. And so, you know, you had some older professionals on there who didn't want to take on that leadership role. And yeah. This young man was very likable and responsible. So I think they just all voted for him when he offered to take on the position.
Interesting. So what qualities, in your opinion, make for an ideal foreperson?
I would pick someone who is able to follow the instructions, who refers back to the instructions, so is able to take that instruction from the court, and that when they swore an oath to follow the law that the court provided, actually follow through with that. So lead the group by going back to the instructions and bringing the group back to the instructions when there are questions. I think someone that is contemplative and listens well, not only because we want someone who's listened to the evidence and can help guide the rest of the group as the foreperson, but also can apply that evidence to that case law, which hopefully they've listened closely to. Also someone who, well, I think you can have a strong personality, someone who is empathetic and willing to listen to other positions and other theories and thoughts before coming to a decision. Because I think that is a huge component of the jury process is allowing voices to be heard, allowing not compromise, we don't want compromise verdicts, but allowing different positions to be heard before a determination is made by the group as to what direction they should head in any case, whether that be civil or criminal.
So you mentioned something about strong opinions before, and so I kind of want to circle back to that. And I wonder if you are ever afraid of questions that elicit a strong reaction and whether there are topics that you completely avoid.
So for me, no, I am never afraid of a strong opinion. I love when I get strong opinions out because if this is an information gathering process and I have limited time, what better way to get information on someone than a strong opinion that leads to others noting their strong opinion. So I want that out. I look at it as I'm trying to smoke out the person that is going to be a problem either on my jury or for my case. And a strong opinion is the easiest way to smoke someone out. So I'm never scared of strong opinions. I am also not scared of topics. One of the things that I always tell folks and that I abide by myself is we want to ensure that our bad facts are out there in any case that we're trying. And that's going to be an opening statement. But a lot of times there's going to be, to the degree you can, you obviously can't try the case in voir dire, but that I can start touching on issues that are going to be difficult that I know are going to be problems. I'm going to talk about those in voir dire to start to see if I can fish out the people that are going to struggle with that or not. And if that's a key component or a concern I have, I'm not scared of asking that question.
So it's interesting that you mentioned that you will introduce bad facts during voir dire. Do you ever have any concern that it might draw too much attention to a bad fact and make it kind of oversized in the potential juror's estimation?
So yes, I think that's a concern, a fair concern, but for me, that's usually not determinative. And I say that because if I know I've got this issue in my case, I'm going to talk to the jury about the fact that we can't try the case in voir dire and we can't talk about facts. So I'm going to set that up in my preamble of that's not what we're doing here. But when I get into an issue, I'm usually going to make it worse than what we actually have. So the jury can think about it. And of course, I'm going to talk about positives as well to the degree I can. But I truly believe juries won't prejudge a case and they're not going to hang up on that fact. And if they are, usually they're going to say something about it. They're going to talk about it, and it's going to draw that strong opinion out, which is the whole point, is if I know this is a big hurdle for me and it is going to potentially cause a problem for me as the facts come out, I want to know if it's a big problem for them now when I get to speak to them, draw that strong opinion out, and now I can hopefully try to eliminate those people from the jury or ensure that I've identified them ahead of time and can figure out ways to mitigate it if it's more than one person and I'm not able to get them off the jury.
So you do it very strategically.
Very strategically.
And at the same time, I would imagine that by you introducing that bad fact in, you know, to whatever degree and in whatever way, it's best for you to be the one doing that rather than opposing counsel beating you to it.
Absolutely.
Because then they're shaping the narrative.
Yes. So I always refer to it as taking the sting out, right? I know the bee is coming and I know the stinger is going to hit me. So how do we remove the sting and how are we going to deal with it when we know it's coming and it's inevitable? I get to frame it.
Do you think that voir dire is a good time for humor? Because I feel like humor has gotten a lot trickier in the last 10, maybe 20 years. What do you think?
I agree with you. I think it has gotten a lot more difficult. Obviously, I think you avoid humor in a, you don't want to do shock jock comedy. I think that's a bad idea if you're at a Starbucks or if you're doing a jury selection process. But humor is always nice to the degree you can make light of something that everyone can relate to. I think sometimes if you can command the room and come in and really show that you are in charge, know your jurors' names, make eye contact, have a plan in place, make it clear that you are the one who is a professional and you're an expert at this, then sometimes not really self-deprecating humor, but you can be somewhat self-deprecating to a limited degree because you've already established that foundation that you are someone who is to be trusted and known. So sometimes you can make that humor just about you or the process. You know, for instance, if it's me making fun of myself for being a history nerd, which I am, and how much I'd like to be on a jury, like that's not hilarious. I don't think it's like a Dave Chappelle moment for anyone, but it brings levity to a process. And while it's serious, we want them to know that there can be levity. We can be people because I want my jurors to be people. I want them to be human beings. And if they are human beings and not closed off, then hopefully we can open them up to get those opinions that I'm concerned about. So soft humor like that, I think, can be useful in limited amounts. It can't be an entire joke session, but I think in limited amounts, it can definitely be useful as a tool to get people to speak more.
Yeah, I think that if you show that you are comfortable with yourself and the process, it puts people at ease. And that little kind of gentle humor that you talk about, it can be a part of that.
I absolutely agree with that. I think it's very true. And putting people at ease is what we want to do, because when people are closed up and uptight and uncomfortable, which, as I always say, a trial process here is such an odd thing, that we have 12 random people get in a room and someone up in a dress that is ordering people to do things and commanding the room from up high. It's weird. It's something we all know and it's great and it's a wonderful process and I fully believe in it, but it is odd if you think about it outside of the context of, well, it's what we've always done and what we always know. So making people at ease as much as you can, knowing that this is such a odd non-day-to-day process, is very important.
You had mentioned a little bit about kind of talking about what the issues are in your case. And so could we talk more about how to use voir dire as a way to signal what's coming up for the potential jurors?
Yes, definitely. And I think you have to be selective again, because time is of the essence, in those issues you want to touch on. And we, of course, have a tendency to want to talk about everything. So you have to be skillful and strategic in what you choose to address. But definitely after it's known and you've established what the case is generally about, touching on those factors that will be a concern. For instance, in any trial, whether it be civil or criminal, credibility is always at issue. The jury is going to receive a credibility instruction in whatever form that comes, whatever court you're in. And so say that there's something in your client or a witness's background, a key witness that helps your case. that they have a felony conviction, that could come in federal court or state court, whatever those rules are. We know that's coming. So maybe we talk about the criminal conviction and is that something that you can put aside? Or while you get to consider it, does that tell you everything about a person? And you know, Ms. Smith, if someone has a criminal conviction for fraud, can you ever listen to them? Could you ever think that they're telling the truth? Or is that fact alone going to say, no, I can't listen anymore? And maybe talking about if it's my witness, people making mistakes, and should they be judged by that? Because again, if it goes back to the instructions, you get to touch on it. So if I know an instruction is coming, if this witness testifies that this conviction would come in at trial, then I get to explore that. And you absolutely should if you think your case rises or falls on the credibility of this individual.
So something happened in Arizona in recent years that listeners may not have heard about. And that is that 2 years ago, Arizona eliminated peremptory strikes in an effort really to try to reduce racial bias in jury selection. And I know that so far in Colorado, that's not the case. And that is where you practice. But there are other states in the United States that have modified strikes, and yet others are considering enacting it. So I just would like to kind of get your gut check on the practice of eliminating those peremptory strikes. What are your thoughts?
So this is being explored in Colorado now, and I think it's happening, as you said, nationwide. So I think Arizona is just the beginning. I will tell you, I think it is definitely something that should be explored. And I say that as a prosecutor and someone who's done civil litigation as well, because I believe racial bias and implicit bias that includes race is something that is pervasive, and it can influence juries. We've seen that in opinions that have come out. We've seen that in certain verdicts that are reviewed on appeal. So it's something that needs to be addressed, because to give the folks who are minorities in our society open access to justice, we need to ensure juries are fair. So the question is how to do that. I think Arizona has addressed that in one way, which is, well, let's just get rid of peremptory strikes, because then we know that the attorneys aren't using potential bias to get rid of jurors. So that's not as pervasive. We know that there's not the potential for that to leak in. Even if that attorney says, I'm not biased, but that implicit bias that they're unaware of is still there. So that is one solution. And frankly, in my view, it's probably the best solution. Well, I would say it's a solution, but it's one of the best solutions to address that. And I say that because what has been explored here in Colorado, and there was a bill that was floated to, for instance, say that prosecutors could not eliminate someone using a peremptory strike if they indicated that they'd had a bad experience with police officers or distrust of police officers. So obviously, again, what we're talking about, and sometimes those experiences are held by minorities. So you would see in our cases here in the Court of Appeals, you have a Black juror or Hispanic juror that indicates concerns about police. And so that would eliminate that person being removed from a jury in a state that is primarily white, Colorado, which of course we want more diversity on our juries, and that would avoid that. Now, the issue is, of course, as a prosecutor side, if there's not an equivalent bar on what if someone says, I trust police and I had a really good experience with a police officer and I think they do a good job. Well, there's nothing barring the other side from eliminating that person with a peremptory strike. So the question then is, what is the best approach? I mean, again, I understand the impetus behind saying, look, we shouldn't be able to eliminate people because they've had a bad experience with police, because that is the reality for a lot of minority folks in our society. But on the other side, is it fair then if someone says, well, look, I trustfully, I'm not going to give them a heads up or put them ahead, but I trust them. I haven't had a bad experience. Is that fair? And I think Arizona, in a lot of ways, addressed that by saying, look, no one gets to do peremptories, because then we're just sure that we're not addressing any of that at all. I think it's a really difficult question. And so I see where Arizona went that way. I'm glad that our Supreme Court is being thoughtful, but I think it's a really hard discussion. I don't think there's an easy solution to it. And so it's going to be interesting to see where things go from here.
Well, it is. And we have a number of judges in Arizona among our faculty members. And so just as a preview, coming up later this year, we will have two Arizona judges coming on the podcast to talk about how these eliminated peremptory strikes are working out. So stay tuned.
Yeah, that will be very interesting, because then the question is, does it risk leaving people on with more bias because, you know, we're not exploring things in a way we would if we had those peremptories? So I'll be fascinated to hear what they have to say.
It's a fair point. So when you do your own peremptory strikes in court, do you do them in open court or do you just do them in a sidebar?
Depends on the judge. I've done them both ways.
I was just wondering, because I know that sometimes if you do it in open court, jurors might, the eliminated juror might be a little taken aback or possibly offended.
Yes. Yes. And that's always the concern, right? And are you offending other jurors?
Yeah.
Because is it, you know, they didn't like what she said, and that's, she was very nice. And why is that man or woman taking her off of this jury? So there again, it's that having the credibility and being the professional in the courtroom and showing command. So anytime I'm faced with that situation, my general practice is to say, you know, Your Honor, at this time, we'd like to thank and excuse Ms. Thomas from the jury, thank you for her time today. And that's all I'll do. And I make eye contact with the juror when we do that, and usually ask that the judge explain to them, you know, what's going on, and our judges are pretty good about explaining they could be struck for any reason. But I'm not going to go out and say, well, I didn't like Ms. Thomas's reaction to that because, you know, she struck me as racist or sexist, so that's why I'm getting rid of her. That's offensive, and we don't need to do that, and there's no need, because peremptories allow you to get rid of a person for any reason. So ensuring that you do that in a professional, tactful way is paramount.
How do jury questionnaires affect your examination of the veneer?
I would say quite greatly, because we get those ahead of time. We use them sparingly in court I currently practice in. So it's usually for high publicity cases or cases with a certain complexity that could touch on an issue, for instance, sex assault cases. Sometimes we'll do that jury questionnaire because that obviously can be a very difficult topic, especially if someone has personal experience that maybe they haven't shared with anyone before or haven't even faced themselves. So that can be incredibly difficult. So where it impacts that general discussion is, so say for instance, it is a sex assault case. Odds are at that point, we're going to have jury questionnaires where that has been ferreted out. So we know if someone's had that experience, they know a family or friend, a family member or friend who's had that experience and how it's impacted them. And so we're going to have those individual discussions or at least know that information ahead of time. So what would be a very important topic in a oral voir dire is removed for me because now I have that voir dire and those responses dialed in. So I have a significant amount of information, which allows me to explore maybe a different topic or explore a different topic more in depth because I have more time. Also, if I have a questionnaire that comes back and say I see a trend of some question that I think is innocuous, lends itself to stronger opinions, I sometimes am going to alter my voir dire to touch on that. Because if I see this, maybe it's not enough to call out one person or to be concerned that the individual person is a problem. I may open it up and start talking about that because I see that a question I didn't expect to generate more information is doing so. So those are really the things I look for is one, can I eliminate now a topic that is huge amounts of information because I already have it? And two, can I explore something where I need more information because I'm surprised by an answer?
Yeah, that's interesting. Are questionnaires mostly online now, or are they ever still handwritten?
For our courts, they're still handwritten. And that's largely, I think, a function of how we call in jurors. Jurors are, they call in the night before, they come in that morning, and then they're handed the questionnaire with their juror number on top. So it's just a matter of how our courts run. That's the way I've seen it done here in Colorado still. I think online could be very advantageous, but we're just not there yet.
I could also see how handwritten ones could be advantageous because maybe with an online questionnaire, you can't advance to the end without answering every single question. Whereas, you know, you can pick and choose with a handwritten one and you can see if somebody has changed their answer. You can kind of get an idea of their word choice and how they answer questions from that too. So it's, I guess there are advantages to both sides, both ways of doing it.
Yes. And I think disadvantages as you bring up, and also just with handwriting, are people more selective? So if they're more invested in an answer, do they write more? Right? Because frankly, you can type a lot easier than you can write by hand.
Yeah, that's true.
At least that's true for me. So yes, are there clues that you can get out of that information that you wouldn't get from an online form that people are used to filling out?
Yeah, it's interesting to kind of read between the lines. So do you also then invest much time in doing an online kind of research or investigation into jurors, like looking up their social media accounts, LinkedIn, blog posts, even if they've been in the news themselves?
To the degree we have time to do so, yes, I try to. I will say again, it's a matter of time. So if we find out who the jury is going to be, who's in the room the morning of, and usually we've talked to the judge and the judge will put the panel in place in order on a randomized list that we get. So literally the trial has started and that is when we figure out who our jurors are. So there is very limited time to run background on them. So to the degree you can, if you have co-counsel or a paralegal or an investigator or someone who it's like, here's a list, take a look. We've tried to do that because my view again is more information is better, no matter what that information is. So that's great as a tool. If it's just me trying a case, which sometimes happens, then my concentration will be on ensuring I memorize those jurors' names, that I'm able to make that connection and then eye contact. So they know I'm invested. So I have that professionalism. That's going to outweigh anything I can get from potentially a Facebook post. Because again, for me, it's about getting that information. I'm going to be able at that moment to get more information by connecting with that person in person and talking to them than I am running down a Facebook search where then I'm scrambling and I don't know people's names and I'm looking down at my chart and looking up and calling someone by the wrong name and then not listening to them and looking back down, which is just not professional or persuasive. So I say do it if you can, but really think about where your time is best served in that moment, depending on when you know who the jurors are going to be and what you can do at that point.
Have you ever had the luxury of doing that research and then just come across something that surprised you and you were like, oh, well, you are an automatic no-go. You are a non-starter.
Yes. So one case was a high-profile cold case homicide that the judge, because it was a small knit community, actually let the attorneys know ahead of time who the jury panel would be because of the size of the community. So we actually had time to have an investigator run background on all of them effectively. And it is amazing if you have time, what people have said on Facebook in the past. And yes, you find out information where you're absolutely going to ensure that someone doesn't end up on a jury. So it can be really useful, but again, it's just a matter of time and what your resources are.
So earlier you said that you would love to be seated on a jury and you're among the rare citizens who feel that way. And I am too. I have worked in law since I was 21 years old, and I'm not going to say how old I am, but it's been a long time since I last got a summons, and it was in Colorado when I still lived there. And that was 11 years ago. And then prior to that, I was in college and I was summoned two or three times. But my number never came up. And now I live in Seattle. I've been here for 10 years. I don't get summons. I've never been seated on a jury. And I'm just wondering, you know, what gives? Why don't I get selected? Is there some kind of preclusion? Is there, I mean, I've worked in law. Do they know that?
So we're having a personal discussion, Marcy, because you're like, why not me? Why can't it be me?
Yeah, I would love it.
Same. And I think it's just the risk of if it's someone that's worked in law or works closely with law, the fear is that are they going to dominate that jury room? Are they going to be a dominant personality that takes away the voices of other jurors? Is it going to be so forceful? Because you're going to, understandably, jurors are going to look to someone that's either a practicing lawyer, has practiced before, or is heavily involved in the law, as someone who knows about this. Because most jurors come to the system, and this is a good thing, not, for instance, criminal cases. A lot of people don't have experiences in the criminal world. They haven't been victims. They haven't been defendants. So this is all new to them. So if you have someone that, oh, well, I practice law, or I know enough to be dangerous, or I am a lawyer that knows this, they're going to look to that person as maybe, well, if I'm questioning or I'm not sure, that I'm going to look to them, and I'm probably going to go along with whatever they say. So I think for me as a trial lawyer, that's always a fear. I will tell you also, it's very interesting, because as much as I want to be in a jury, if I were able to sit, if I were able to get summoned and sit there, I would also be sure to not be too eager, because I also, people who are too eager to be on a jury scare me. So, because I'm worried why you want to be on a jury this bad, because of course I want to be on a jury because I believe in the process. I believe in the Constitution. I believe in due process, and we need good people. If not me, then who, right? We need good people to do that. But if you're that eager to be on a jury, because I still have a life and I have a family and I have a job that I can't do if I'm here. So while I'm excited, I also know what the back end of this looks like. And I think that's normal. So my concern is, if someone is that excited and that eager to be on a jury, what is going on with them that they, it's a reaction that I'm always a little bit scared of.
Yeah, well, that's funny. It sounds like there's no hope for me. I should just give up the dream. Okay, so my very last question about voir dire is about war stories. And in my experience, cops and trial lawyers always seem to have the most interesting, entertaining stories. And so I wonder if you have any memorable war stories or things that have happened to you during jury selection that you might share.
Yes, I have a couple. So, as I said, jury selection always is just a unique beast. I feel like it's like walking into a classroom or a bar where it's like, whoa, the vibe here is one way or another, right? Like, this place is friendly or fun, or this place is really uptight and scary, or, you know, it's just sort of, you get a group of people together and there's a vibe about it. So that is always unique. But on individual jurors, I have a couple of stories. One, as I said earlier, the goal is always to get more information, and I'm going to get information out no matter what. And so there's a sex assault trial where, you know, it's not a stranger case. The victim and the defendant knew each other. And so I want to explore that. Like I said, oftentimes in a sex assault trial, there's going to be really strong feelings one way or another on just, you know, someone being touched by it. It's, there's sometimes a, you know, they said, right? You have two people saying what happened in a room, and how do you judge credibility? So we're going to have a lot of very difficult issues in that trial. And so one of the questions to address this, because it's going to be, you know, what is consent and what does consent mean? A question that I asked to get out strong opinions is, you know, you're here for a sex assault trial, and I want to ask a very broad question, and we'll be talking about difficult things, but who here thinks that someone that, say, is a sex worker, can they be sexually assaulted? Like, can they be, or does their job just eliminate that? And I had an individual that responded, surprisingly, and I'm always surprised, with, well, has money exchanged hands? And so this is comes into, also, there's no bad answers in jury selection. So frankly, I hear this answer and I am horrified that someone would answer this way, right? I was like, and I did the whole preamble of a sex worker, like, we're going to put, you know, whatever got this person to this position, we don't want to talk about, but this is their profession. Can they be sexually assaulted? So the answer is, well, has money exchanged hands? And I said, sure, let's say it had. Well, absolutely not then. And so again, I'm horrified. But the answer is, Mr. Williams, thank you so much for sharing that. You know, this is a difficult topic to talk about. While inside me is like, I can't believe someone actually thinks this way about this. But again, to what we've talked about a couple times, Marcy, it's about getting that information out, because I know this individual is not going to be on my jury anymore. So that is one story where that was fascinating and frightening. Other jurors responded very appropriately, right? But just getting that information out. The other story I'll tell is when I was a younger attorney, and it was a DUI trial I had. And there are oftentimes jurors who just do not want to be there for whatever reason. And, you know, they've talked to a friend who's told them how to get off of a jury, or they've just decided to get creative. And so I just asked sometimes the kitchen sink question of, is there any reason you can't be on this jury? And a gentleman raised his hand and said, well, I just had stomach surgery. I was like, okay, well, that, you know, I'm sorry you went through that, but that's, you know, I'm glad that you're sharing that. Can you please explain? I guess I'm not clear on, you know, what's going on with you. He's like, well, I've got issues. And I was like, okay. He's like, you know, I'm just, it's possible that I'm just going to soil myself. And it's, you know, it's, that's just, it's like colon and there's a bunch of stuff going on. And I go, okay, well, I don't, you know, thank you, but how about if we take breaks, we can have you raise your hand. And this individual, I won't go more into detail, but in very explicit detail, explained everything that would happen to him and the other jurors if he remained on the jury panel, which I knew pretty quickly when it seemed to, it did not seem to be credible what he was talking about.
Oh.
But I decided to ask a couple more questions because, like, well, if you don't want to be on the jury that badly and you're willing to tell this story, which is incredibly embarrassing, then you should share that in full detail so we know why you can't be here, and then we'll make sure you're not on our jury.
Oh,
so it is also incredible what people will say to get off of a jury. That is the most personally embarrassing one that I shared. And as I said, it became clear that that was not a real story as he continued to talk.
Yeah, it takes all types, I'll tell you.
Yes, it does.
All right. Well, we've reached the end of our substantive portion of the interview. And so I just have two sign-off questions that I want to ask. And the first one, you mentioned when you were, you just talked about how you were a young attorney. And so this question relates to that. And it is, what do you know now about litigation and trial practice that you wish you would have known when you started out?
I think all trial lawyers are very confident, and you don't go into this field without some confidence to get into court and try to run the show. And I think the thing I realize now is how much I don't know and how much room there is for various opinions and thoughts and being empathetic to not only the parties involved in the case, but also the jurors that are judging your case. And I say that because opening yourself up to that empathy and knowing you don't know everything, or being open to other people knowing more, even on a topic you think you know, allows you to understand jurors better, explain the facts in a way that is more persuasive, and understand that you can touch all of them and explain the case in a way that they'll understand and hopefully go along with you. So it's that slowing down and ensuring that you take in all perspectives before making decisions. That includes in trial too, being open to different ideas and thoughts.
And the last question, what TV show or movie have you enjoyed recently?
Let's see, TV show that I've enjoyed recently. So I ended up rewatching a season of True Detective, which generally I try to avoid crime shows just because of my current job as a prosecutor. I feel like for my own mental health, I like to avoid that. But that season, I'd watched it before, is just so well done, and the acting is so great, and it brings in, I think, twists that are so unique that I enjoyed it in a way I didn't expect, again, because usually I avoid dramas or, you know, any sort of 48 Hours that deals with my type of work, because I see enough of that and I don't need to bring it home. So that was a great one just because of the storytelling, the acting. I loved it.
Well, I don't know if this is good news for you or bad, but the new season of True Detective just started this week.
And it's funny, that's why I rewatched the first season, because I'm like, do I really want to bite this off? And so I've decided I'm going to look at the new season because Jodie Foster. And then my understanding is the whole season is based on a real life, I guess, crime scene that was found in Russia, I believe, years ago. And so just the whole conceptualization of that sounds interesting. So I may dive back into True Detective again.
All right. Well, it sounds like it's got a hook that's working for you.
Yes. Yes.
Well, great.
Well, thank you for your time and for inviting me to do this.
Well, of course. Thank you for making time for us, too. If you'd like to learn how to be an even better trial advocate under Adam Kendall's skilled instruction, you are in luck. He'll be among our top-tier faculty members teaching at the Building Trial Skills course next month in New Orleans, and it is not too late to register. The New Orleans course is the ideal time and place to up-level your competence and self-confidence before you seat jurors in your next case. The link is in the show notes, and we hope we'll see you there. As always, thank you so much for listening and subscribing. I hope you'll tune in next month when we will be back on the Deposition Skills beat, and you won't want to miss it. Until then, happy lawyering. May the Record Reflect is a NIDA Studio 71 production. NIDA, we are advocacy enhanced, mentorship reimagined. Welcome to the community.